This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's been 40 years now since the creation of the Buy-Dole Act, and on this 40th anniversary, it shows how our nation's economy has grown over the years, and it was all in large part because of not only the efforts of then-Senator Birch Bayh and then-Senator Bob Dole, as well as a private public partnership that helped bring this all about. And we'll find out more about the Buy-Dole Act on this 40th anniversary. We have with us Chris Bayh, who is the son of Senator Birch Bayh, who is an attorney with Barnes & Thornburg, and also Joe Allen, who is the executive director of Buy-Dole 40, as it is called, the organization that honors this particular act. He's a former staff member for former Senator Birch Bayh. And Joe and Chris, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for inviting me here.
Well, first, let me ask, for people that are not familiar, that are not economists, that really understand how important the Buy-Dole Act really is, will you tell us more about the benefits of the Buy-Dole Act, and what are some of the innovations that we live with now almost every day and have become really big economic boosts that have come about because of this legislation?
Well, this is Joe Allen. Let me take a first crack at that, since I was on Senator Bayh's staff, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Before the Buy-Dole Act, the government right now funds about $140 billion, with a B, in research and development every year, and covers soup to nuts, from basic research to applied research for defense. Before the Buy-Dole Act, if an invention was made with that funding, the government took the invention away and tried to make it available to anyone who wanted it. The problem was that the government doesn't develop products. So if the government makes an invention, it's usually a very early stage invention made at a university or a contractor. It's much more like an idea than a product, and it takes a lot of private sector risk and expense and time to turn that into something that's actually useful. So before Buy-Dole, virtually no inventions were being commercialized when the government took the rights away. And what Buy-Dole did was it reversed that. Said if a university or small company makes an invention with federal funding, they can own it, the government can use it, but then they put incentives back in the system to find somebody in the private sector to actually commercialize it so it actually would be turned into something useful. And 40 years later, the Buy-Dole Act has made at least $1.7 trillion with a T contribution to the economy.
Wow.
It's supporting like 6 million new jobs. We create three companies a day, and three new technologies are commercialized every day from Buy-Dole. And the Economist Technology Quarterly said Buy-Dole was possibly the most inspired act of the last 50 years and did more than anything else to turn around America's decline into industrial irrelevance. So it really has been a seminal bill.
I understand that it was a way, I guess, to help bring the nation out of the economic doldrums back in the 1970s.
Chris, you go ahead.
I think that was perhaps a big reason behind that. And I'll tell you from my dad's perspective, my dad grew up during the Great Depression. He was in high school during World War II, not quite old enough to fight in it. And he witnessed in his life the American economy take at least two huge leaps forward. One, of course, during and following World War II, as American economics and manufacturing just fundamentally changed. And he got to not only see that as a young man from his own experiences, but as the son of an Army colonel serving overseas in the Army Air Corps. And then as a young senator, starting in the early 60s, he got to see and participate in the Great Society and all the economic and innovation development that America undertook during that part of the Cold War and the 60s and early 70s, and just really saw, as he would tell me, the American innovation and economy start to flag a bit, and identified this as one of the things that was dragging it.
The act has helped bolster economic output by $1.3 trillion and supported more than 4 million jobs and has launched thousands and thousands of startup companies. Chris, do you think that your dad had ever imagined that this piece of legislation would have such a profound impact on American life?
Honestly, I think he did. I think that was the point. Joe, you were there. You can speak to that much more directly, but I think that's exactly what he wanted. Now, I don't think that he could project all the statistics, and maybe he wouldn't have anticipated 4.2 million jobs, but this is exactly what he and Joe and the men and women who made this legislation happen were trying to do. And I think that he would be very happy to know, or I think he, excuse me, I know he was happy to know. He had a long life after this was passed. After the legislation was enacted, he passed just last year, and he was gratified to know the statistics of the impact that the Biden life had. But he focused much more on the stories, on the life-saving technologies that were developed that can be attributable to the Biden life, the way that the American economy has been able to develop and stay competitive, the specific innovation, specific ways that it's impacted individual people. That's what he talked about most.
One thing that, one of the reasons this was bipartisan, because Birch Bayh and Bob Dole were about as far apart politically as you could be. It's sort of like Elizabeth Warren and Ted Cruz working together now. But I think both of them realized you couldn't just squander hundreds of billions of dollars of federal research. And when we first looked into Bayh Dole, the Comptroller General told us not a single drug had ever been commercialized from the billions and billions of dollars of NIH-funded research because there was no incentives for it. So I think Senator Bayh and Senator Dole and all of us realized we had to do better than that. And if you fast forward to today, more than 300 drugs and vaccines are on the market now. The U.S. has established its lead in every field of technology. In fact, one of the reasons we're having such a tremendous response to the COVID-19 crisis is because of Bayh Dole. So our public and private sectors can work together and know that the rules are not going to be changed and the rug's not going to be pulled out from under them. And it really has had a phenomenal impact. Chris, you'd also ask about some examples. Well,
right.
Google came out of Bayh Dole.
Mm-hmm.
HDTV came out of Bayh Dole. Allegra came out of Bayh Dole. Airport scanners, hepatitis B and C vaccines, CitraCal, flu mist, electronic banking. So people's lives have been impacted. But I think even more than that, it reestablished America as the undisputed leader in innovation in the world. If you look back to when we were passing Bayh Dole, the smart people in Washington were saying that our days were numbered. Japan and Germany were going to blow us off the road. And that didn't happen. And one of the reasons was because Bayh Dole gave incentives for the public and private sectors to work together, just had a few rules, got the government out of the way, and really reestablished incentives for people to step in and take risks. And the results have been tremendous.
Now, you gentlemen both mentioned earlier that the fact that Birch Bayh and Bob Dole got together and did something difficult, if not impossible, to even dream of happening these days here, with Senator Bayh working across the aisle to come up with this this measure. With the great political climate that we are experiencing these days, and it seems almost unfathomable to expect anything like this. How do you think that the bipartisan nature of the Bayh-Dole Act has contributed to its success over the last 40 years?
This is Joe Allen again. It's made all the difference in the world. If you look at, this was passed in the waning days of the Carter administration. As soon as Ronald Reagan came in, he made Bayh Dole the centerpiece of his technology policies. And every president since then, Republican and Democrat, Carter, Obama, even Donald Trump, have all embraced Bayh Dole. And that just made a fantastic difference because it's been a stable law. It hasn't been changed. And it lets people know that the rules are not going to be switched all of a sudden if the politics of the administration change. So without the bipartisanship of Bayh Dole, it really would never have survived for 40 years.
Now, Chris, since this act has your father's name on it, why do you think that the Bayh Dole Act has been able to stay so consequential over the years, despite all the political acting of these days, at least?
Sure. Well, I tell you, your point about bipartisanship is an important one, and especially looking at it through the lens of today. I think that my dad would caution, though, that this Bayh Dole Act is not necessarily emblematic of the time. It was the bipartisan nature of this was notable for that, even for that time, as he liked to say, and as he's written about. They got Ted Kennedy and Strom Thurmond to co-sponsor the bill. That never happened. Getting those two folks on board on the same piece of legislation was incredibly rare. And I think he would probably say that that shows you that things like this can be achieved today. But I think the fact that you can't throw rocks back at it based on partisan ideology and how it has fed into the advancement of American excellence, something that both parties can get behind, I think is very important for its longevity.
Now, you talk about the fact that we had so many people in Congress at the time, in the Senate, of course, that decided to join along and help make sure that the Bayh-Dole Act became law. What role would the Bayh-Dole Act play today during our pandemic years, we should say? Well, can the law actually help the creation of vaccines or treatments for the coronavirus?
Joe, I'll let you take that one.
It absolutely is. In fact, it's phenomenal that, you know, we've actually developed vaccines and drugs, which are in the last stages of testing right now. Moderna, actually, which has the leading vaccine, licensed two patents from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania under Bayh-Dole. They've been collaborating with the government ever since then. Before Bayh-Dole, it wouldn't have happened because a company, if they brought an invention into federal research, if something else was invented, the government would take the whole thing away from them. And even though both sides are funding development, the private sector is funding much more of the development of COVID vaccines and drugs than the federal government is. It's a partnership, but the risk is really on the private sector side. They couldn't have taken that risk without Bayh-Dole. And if you look at Gilead's drug Remdesivir, which actually President Trump just used, that's another drug that has been developed in cooperation with universities and the public sector. Again, those partnerships wouldn't happen without Bayh-Dole, because Gilead would be afraid, if they actually work with the public sector, that it would all be taken away from them at the last minute.
Yeah.
So, in fact, you know, there's every day now you're getting inventions coming out of universities on testing, on respirators, just across the board because of Bayh-Dole, and they're being brought to the market in record time. I mean, this is almost like World War II time frames. It's just incredible. No one in the world is moving as fast as we are to come up with new drugs, vaccines, and other things we need to protect public health, not just here, but around the world.
Joe and Chris, what do each of you see, and you've kind of alluded to some of this before here, about the most important legacy of the Bayh-Dole Act? What, Chris, why don't you start out, please?
Sure. I can go on, of course, about the stats, the economic impact it's had in terms of numbers. I'll tell you what was most important to my dad that he talked about most when it came to Bayh-Dole, and that's how it became law, the process by which it became law. Now, we talked about the ultimate bipartisan support that the act enjoyed, but it was nearly blocked at committee level. It's a much more of a legislative near miss than the bipartisan support would suggest. And it took a very, very strong and underdog effort from a lot of very dedicated men and women, most of them young men and women, folks like Joe, who advocated for universities and small businesses and other allies. They really pull out every stop to get in front of the senators and congressmen and stakeholders to make them understand why this was imperative that they vote yes, that they get enough support to have this bill pass. Mm-hmm. And that was a lesson that my dad took away from his public life. And Bayh-Dole was probably the clearest example of it. You put together just a few dedicated individuals, not powerful people, but students and staffers, and young men and women, and those people and their hard work makes all the difference. And that is the blueprint for how you make a difference and you get important things enacted in the future. To quote from something that my dad wrote a few years ago, it's amazing that these young men and women could harness the effort that provided us with Bayh-Dole. And certainly those of us who face this challenge a generation later should be willing to stand up and be counted. If we don't do it, who will? To him was most important.
Certainly seems true today. And Joe, what do you feel in your heart is the most important legacy that Bayh-Dole Act is bringing to all of us now?
Well, I think one thing is it reestablished the importance of free societies and making sure that the public laws are dependable. Bayh-Dole did not create any new bureaucracy. It didn't cost taxpayers an additional dime, which is astounding when you look at what it did. It provided incentives, it set up a few rules, and then got government out of the way. And it's ironic now that Bayh-Dole has become the best practice around the world. The Chinese have adopted Bayh-Dole. Other than Kazakhstan a couple years ago, they've adopted Bayh-Dole. South Africa's adopted Bayh-Dole. Korea's adopted Bayh-Dole. Japan has adopted Bayh-Dole. They're all using our model, and every time I talk to them, I said, look, If you want this thing to work, you can't micromanage the system. You have to let entrepreneurs take the risk, stand back. Some are going to fail. Some are going to make it. But if you just trust the system and trust the incentives, in fact, these technologies are starting to develop. So I think it's been a renounding reaffirmation that free societies and free economies work much more than controlled economies. Biden is not controlled from the top down. It's driven from the bottom up. It's not Washington-centric. It deregulated invention ownership from Washington, D.C. to people like Purdue, Notre Dame. Let them understand what they did. Let them put the risk together. And the results have been astounding.
Chris Bayh is the son of Senator Birch Bayh. Joe Allen is one of Senator Bayh's former staffers, and he's the executive director of what is called Bayh Dole 40, the Bayh Dole Act, which has become such the biggest part of our economic growth over the decades, is 40 years old this year. And gentlemen, thank you for joining us to talk about this. We appreciate your comments and your thoughts, and let's hope that this very unusual, at least it seems these days, bipartisanship can turn back again and we can get back to this role of being able to work across the aisle more often. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. As part of the America Amplified initiative, we have a series of reports beginning today on young women who are pushing for change in their Indiana communities. Voting is a big issue as we get closer to Election Day, but it isn't the only way people are making their voices heard this year. Over the past few months, Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson has been following four young activists, and today we meet Taylor Hall, a 20-year-old who helped organize one of the summer's biggest protests in Indianapolis.
My name is Taylor Hall. I am 20 years old. I started protesting after the killing of Drayjean Reed on May 6, 2020. And since then, I've just been protesting every week, every day for social justice. Drayjean Reed is an Indianapolis man. He was on Facebook Live on May 6 when he was getting pulled over by the police. It was a high-speed chase. It started on the interstate downtown and went up Michigan Road, which is kind of in the middle of Indianapolis. In the live video, you see him driving away from the police, and he got out of the car and started running. And then in the video, you can hear about 8 gunshots and see him fall to the ground. That sparked the movement, I'd say, in Indianapolis because of how close it was to everyone. It definitely was I'd say kind of weird and kind of surreal to see how many people in Indianapolis came out for this cause. Indiana is a very conservative state, so just to see so many people of so many different backgrounds and ethnicities, all different races and ages and genders coming out to support is amazing. We need not just legislative change, but we also need change in our communities. We need to uplift each other. We need to support each other. We need to continue to work together to fight this battle of racism and social injustice. We can come out and protest, but nothing's going to change unless we vote. We change the people in office so that they are working for our best interest to be made and for policies and legislations to be made that will benefit the oppressed groups inside of the community. So we had to stress at every protest and sit in that, yes, thank you for showing up for this protest, but also show up at the voting polls. And we had voter registration so that they would, because without voting, then there will be no change and there will be no differences made in our communities. I started making music after the killing of George Floyd. My father wrote the song I Can't Breathe, and it's about what happened to him and about what's happening inside of our society today. One line is it 2020 or 1969? I knew if people didn't understand me through my protest or yelling, they might understand it through my music, or they might understand it through my artwork, or they might understand it through my clothing choices. I want to try to bridge the gap between government officials and the youth. If I ask any kids that I'm working with, who's your mayor, who's your governor, who's your representative, they're not going to know. And I think that's a problem. The next generation is the future, and they're going to be here a lot longer than we are. So if we don't empower them and make them feel a part of this movement, if they don't feel a part of this and they don't see why we're protesting, then we'll be 20 years, 50 years, 100 years later, still protesting for the same things that we were protesting for and our ancestors were protesting for.
That's Taylor Hall, and we have part two of our series coming to you tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. Politics are getting more and more divisive as we move toward the November election, and that's playing out in the city of Goshen, Indiana, a little blue dot in a mostly red rural county. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports on how one block of Main Street in Goshen has become a lightning rod for political tension and maybe even conversation.
Goshen's Main Street is a simple two-lane street, but it gets a lot of traffic. It's one of the most direct ways in and out of town. On one side of the street, there's a yard that's impossible to miss. It's festooned with colorful hand-painted signs that say, "Love immigrants, not illegals," "Support ICE," and "BLM, burn, loot, murder." Trump and American flags sway in the breeze. In the middle of it all, Lori Arnold sits on the sidewalk in a camping chair and waves at drivers.
I've been called cheeky before. I love that, because I am. And I just smile.
Arnold began demonstrating in June. She's had water thrown on her, her sign set on fire, and even suspects someone intentionally loosened the hubcaps on her truck. Every now and then, drivers slow down and yell at her.
Racist. Homophobic. Yeah, I get called that all the time. The racist thing, especially. Which, you know, like I'm not... How do you say I'm not racist? You know, I'm not racist. But that's the perception that you get automatically.
Jeremy Stutzman, mayor of Goshen, says this situation feels representative of how divided politics in the country are right now. He wants to protect Arnold's right to demonstrate, but he's also worried her actions encourage politically motivated violence.
That's definitely escalating. It went from arguments to harassment to there's a battery charge and now there's arson. So we have growing concerns.
For a week in August, that block of Main Street was especially hard to ignore. Lupita Romo stood on the opposite sidewalk, countering Arnold's signs and flags with her own. She doesn't condone any of the violence towards Arnold, but as a DACA recipient, she understands the anger.
I was outraged. It almost hurt. First, it was just anger, like pure anger. I didn't think that people here in Goshen felt that way.
Romo's friends joined her. They stood on the other side of the street for days, draped in Mexican and Salvadoran flags. It seemed Lori's side of the street and Romo's side of the street might never meet. But things changed a little one day. Lori was struggling to get the pole for an American flag into the ground. So Romo crossed over to help her out and the two started talking, and kept talking for over an hour. Romo says to her surprise, the conversation was actually really pleasant. They actually agreed on a lot of things.
I could see a different side of Lori and not think that she was just crazy and like this racist lady. Because I really don't... I want to say that she's not racist.
Arnold says she was never really interested in politics or protest before. But when she watched a video of George Floyd being killed by police, she had to do something. But she was equally disturbed by cable news footage of destructions from protests across the country.
I would have been out protesting police violence, but it just got taken over by a hijacked or whatever by this Black Lives Matter. So instead of that, now I'm out protesting for the police.
Arnold says her signs are intentionally provocative. She wants strong reactions to force people to talk.
I know that I am being controversial maybe with the way I word things sometimes. You may not like it, but it causes you to stop and talk to me about it. And I think that that is worth pissing a couple people off.
But at least with Romo, the conversation didn't last. Arnold later posted a picture of Romo and her friends on Facebook, calling them goons.
And that's when I was like, you know what, this isn't going to work out. I'm just going to go off of what you're doing in public. There's nothing to really say or do about that.
The result of that conversation is unfortunate, says Leah Namias. She puts together tough conversations for Indiana Humanities.
If you really want to have a conversation, don't start with trying to provoke an emotional response.
Namias thinks Arnold's in-your-face approach may be getting reactions, but probably isn't a good starting point for productive dialogue.
It is to get a reaction from somebody. And a reaction is not the same as a conversation.
Arnold says she's not sure how long she'll continue, but imagines she'll keep going until at least the November election. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.